This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
Do you know what time it is? Odds are you do, but why? And who decided what time it is right now? Hi, I'm David Rankin.
And I'm Kristen Diaz. Join us as we explore the history of time, how we determined what time it is, and why we change it twice a year to save daylight. This is How Time Works, an Odyssey Conversation.
Time runs our lives.
It determines whether we're early or late.
It sets our expectations whether it should be light or dark out.
But what is the time? What determines it?
Chad Orzel is a physics professor at Union College in Schenectady, New York. He's the author of the book, A Brief History of Timekeeping.
So Chad, what is the history of timekeeping?
The fundamental thing about timekeeping is you always need some kind of tick that you can use as a clock, right? Some regular repeated process that you count to measure how much time has gone by. So the most obvious of these is the motion of the sun across the sky, right? It rises in the east-ish and goes across the sky and sets in the west-ish, and that marks a day. And you can use that as a really crude tick. You know, it's a very slow clock, but it is a clock of sorts because it has this repeated motion that you can look at and count and say, okay, this many days have passed. You can subdivide the day by looking at, say, the angle of the shadow of a stick pointed vertically in the ground, which, you know, in the middle of the day will point due south. The shadow will point due south. And you know, at sunrise, it'll point mostly west, and at sunset, it'll point mostly east. And you can watch that shadow sweep across the ground and use that, you know, use exactly where it is as a way to subdivide the day and say, well, it's not, you know, it's not the middle of the day yet because we haven't passed the due south point. And so that's the sort of start of timekeeping, is just tracking the position of the sun as it moves across the sky from east to west.
How did we used to keep track of time before we had clocks?
So the oldest way of keeping track of time independent of the sun is a thing called the water clock, which is basically the earliest ones, and these date back to thousands of years BCE. The oldest ones are basically just like a big container with a small hole in the bottom. You fill it up with water to some level, and you let the water drain out, And, you know, as the water drains out, the level of the water slowly goes down. And if you have the container shaped right, you know, you can keep track of what time it is, how much time has elapsed by where the level of the water has dropped to. And that's the state of the art in timekeeping up into, you know, up into the 1200s, kind of, is the best way that people keep track of time. Even up at later than that, into the 1600s, when Galileo Galilei is doing experiments with pendulums, his most sensitive timekeeping was a water clock that he would collect the water that flowed out while the pendulum was swinging back and forth, and then weigh it to determine how much time it elapsed. There's sort of, you know, public timekeeping devices. There are big sundials in Greek and Roman cities and things like that. And there were sort of civic services where, you know, they would beat drums or sound trumpets, you know, at regular intervals through the day, so everybody knew what time it was, which allows you, you know, once you're dealing with more than like, you know, a couple of families in neighboring houses, you need to be able to sort of coordinate.
How do we get to the point that we now have four time zones in the continental United States?
Yeah, so there's this connection between time and geography, right? Because the Earth is a sphere, right? Different people at different positions will see the sun at different elevations in the sky. And so, you know, as you move east to west, the exact instant at which, you know, the sun is at its highest point varies as you go from place to place. And that's not a problem until you can move pretty quickly, right? So, you know, if the fastest transportation available to you is riding a horse, you're not going to move east or west far enough to notice that noon happens at a different time in your destination than it did at the place that you left. But once you get into the 1800s, you start to have railroads, you can actually cover enough ground rapidly enough that you start to see that problem. You could get on a train in New York City and be, you know, in the middle of Ohio by the end of the day in the 1800s. And the time of sunset is substantially later in Ohio than it would be in New York. So, you know, for millennia, we subsisted on this system where every municipality had kind of its own clock based on the position of the sun. And that was fine because nobody could get from, you know, one place to another fast enough to see that difference. But once you have railroads, and especially the telegraph that sort of grew up alongside the railroads, once you have that, you can cover enough ground fast enough that it starts to become important that different places are experiencing different times of day.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. 5-Hour Energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
Survivor 48 is here. And after every episode, dig deep into the show with On Fire, the official Survivor podcast. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
How long did it take before the government did step in to standardize time through law?
Yeah, the process of standardization of time zones in the United States happens, I like to joke that it happens in the most American way imaginable, which is it's implemented by large corporations in an effort to head off government action. Right. The railroad companies were operating sort of networks of trains, and they need to schedule them. They need to make sure that, you know, you don't have two trains going different directions on the same stretch of track, things like that. They need passengers to be able to get from one train to another. And they're already coordinating this over a fairly wide range. And it's just one of a system of different local times that's there. But in the 1860s, 1870s, there starts to be a push from some scientists lobbying the government to standardize time more widely. because they want to be able to coordinate. It starts with a particular guy named Cleveland Abbe, who wanted to coordinate astronomical observations over very large distances. And so he starts lobbying for some standardization of time. And an executive with the railroad looked at this and said, well, you know, if we let this guy have Congress do it, we're going to end up with a system we don't like. So he drew up a scheme that involved, you know, standardized time zones where we would just agree that everything over a wide swath of geography is at the same time. And he drew the boundaries of those based on where the railroad networks naturally ended. So, you know, where one company traded off to another company, that's where the boundary was. And that falls very close to our modern system of, you know, Eastern, Central, Mountain, and Pacific times. He got all the railroads to sign on to that, and then the railroads just sort of used their you know, clout with the local governments to get all the municipalities to sign on and agree that, okay, we're going to change our clocks to coordinate with the railroads, and everything in the Eastern time zone, it'll be, you know, it'll all the clocks will say 10 o'clock, and once you get to, you know, St. Louis, everything is going to say, you know, 9 o'clock. And they just agreed on that based on these railroad boundaries. So they were doing it to head off having Congress implement the system that they probably would have liked less.
But where does daylight saving time come from?
So the logic is it starts in World War I in Europe and in the UK. And the idea is to, by shifting the clocks, you can make the daylight hours appear to last longer. And in so doing, then you don't have people using fuel for producing light. You know, you're not burning gas to make you know, light in people's houses. You're not burning gas to generate electricity to power electric lights, and that frees up fuel resources to go to the war effort. So it was an energy conservation measure implemented during World War I. And then it gets picked up by other countries at around the same time for more or less the same reasons. Like we need all of this fuel to power military hardware. We can save a little bit if people don't have to generate artificial light in the evening. So let's just shift the clocks so that the sun is up later in the evening. And that works pretty well.
How long did wartime stick around initially?
So it's implemented in 1918 when the U.S. is in the war. Congress, you know, finally standardizes the time zones and implements a daylight savings time scheme. And then it sort of falls off a little bit during the interwar era, comes back again in World War II. And it's kind of hit or miss for a couple of decades there. It's 1966 that Congress sort of says, okay, we need to standardize this. We can't have like individual counties deciding whether they're springing forward and falling back. It's got to be on a statewide level, and it's got to sort of sync up with the time zones. And you end up with the modern scheme where, you know, there's time zones, the boundaries of the time zones fall along state lines. The states decide whether they're in or out on daylight savings time. In circa 2020, it's only Arizona and Hawaii that aren't doing daylight savings. Indiana was kind of a wild card for a while there. And so it's pretty locked in by the 1960s.
Didn't we have a stretch of time where daylight saving time wasn't universal?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's why there's a Uniform Time Act in the mid-60s that sort of locks this down. It's okay, this is crazy. We can't have, you know, it changing on that short a scale. It's kind of got to be statewide. Let's have all the states, you know, as a whole state, either you're in or you're out on the time change.
Now, where do farmers fit into all of this when it comes to daylight saving time?
Not especially. I mean, farmers, you know, farming is a hard life, right? You got to get up at, you know, more or less sunrise whenever that happens. And, you know, in a lot of the year, they're getting up before sunrise. So, you know, the exactly when the sun rises and sets is not as huge a concern. They're kind of, you know, up before the dawn and you know, well after going to bed well after sunset year round. So it's not a huge factor in that.
It's crazy to think how far back we've been working to keep track of time, but it's also a symbol of human innovation to basically make time work for us, right?
Yeah, it's really fun. And you know, looking at the history of it is really fascinating because it's literally thousands of years of people doing clever things to keep track of what time it is. We think of it sometimes as a modern obsession, right? That everything's tied to the clock now and everybody's constantly worried about what time it is and am I late, am I early? But you can find people worrying about that, 4,000 years ago. And that's kind of, comforting to know that this is just people. It's a people thing. It's not a modern thing. And it also highlights the fact that there's, at the end of the day, there's sort of a fundamental arbitrariness to all of this that, we're picking a thing that we're going to count as the ticks of our clock and use to measure time. But that choice is always kind of driven by convenience, right? Is what is going to be the easiest way for me to keep track of things and to coordinate things. And that ends up having some really profound consequences when you start thinking about the science and the philosophy of time. So, and time zones and daylight savings time are a really nice illustration of that.
The first place most people experience a rigid schedule is in school.
Dr. Kyla Wahlstrom is a research fellow and lecturer at the University of Minnesota. She was recently the director of the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement at the university.
What's the general concept when it comes to school schedules? Why are they and why have they been the way that they have been?
That's an interesting question because it varies by location. But I can tell you that I was a former school administrator for almost 20 years before I became a research professor. And school districts set their work schedules, their class schedules, and their bus schedules pretty much based on historically what they have done in the past. So people have believed that, and this is during the agricultural agrarian times, people believe that the oldest students would go first, then the junior high or middle school students, and finally the elementary school students would be bused last. It's interesting because as we in the medical field have found very interesting information about the circadian rhythms, the brain sleep schedules for teenagers, the school schedule should actually be flipped so that the youngest children who tend to wake up early, if you've had a child at home and you know that they tend to wake up at 6:37 in the morning, they're raring to go. And often that seems to be the best time for elementary schools to begin would be the first round of the busing schedules. Mm-hmm. Next would be the middle schools and finally the high schools. So it's basically been a matter of precedent and habit that school districts set those schedules to have high school first, start first, then middle school, and then elementary.
There's been a push to have schools start later. What's the source of the conversation about when schools start their day?
It's interesting because in 1996, I did the first research that looked at a high school that made a change to a later starting time. And from 1996 until today, there has been over 1,000 school districts in the U.S. that have made that change to where high schools begin latest and the elementary students generally begin earlier than high schools. That conversation has taken these past 26 years to happen across districts across the United States. Specifically, the states of California and Florida have made a statewide decision to have teenagers in high school begin the latest of all of the bus routes in the daytime of the school schedule. That's because the medical research is very clear that adolescents have a very different sleep-wake schedule than do pre-adolescent children. So the human brain doesn't really allow teenagers to fall asleep because of the hormonal development during teenage years until about 10:30 or 11 at night. And then we also know that teenagers need to have about 9 hours or 9 hours and 15 minutes would be the premium amount of time that teenagers should sleep. So if you factor in the brain change for their sleep schedule with the early starting time of high schools, and you have a real crash of mental health, sleepiness, and other serious factors, health factors that have to do with the teenagers getting up early to go to school. So all of this medical information formed the national conversation about why it is a public health policy for teenagers to have the latest school starting time. And that's what the states of California and Florida have, their legislatures had discussed this and decided this was good public health policy to have teenagers in their high schools be the latest starting schools in a school district.
Now, flipping the schedule around could create some challenges for some families, like an older sibling being able to watch a younger sibling while the parents are at work.
Absolutely true. And you know, it's interesting that those are the kinds of discussions that in the school districts that have made the change, there have been excellent local discussions about how to solve those kinds of realistic problems, because they are realistic challenges that schools and parents and bus companies, transportation directors have to face. Now, that said, it's also not good public health policy to have teenagers going to school early just so they can be babysitters for younger children. So that aside, then, if that is not good public health policy just to, you know, keep them as babysitters, the school districts that have successfully accommodated the change have instituted excellent after-school childcare at the school district, perhaps on a sliding fee scale. They've worked with local daycare providers to bring the children to the daycare homes instead of the children's family home. Parents have had their work schedules being altered or changed by their employers as needed. There are many other things, the local YMCA, YWCA, those kinds of community ed programs also have been able to rise to the occasion that would have them participating in the solution for what to do about the younger kids when they're dismissed earlier than the teenage kids.
What about teacher and staff perspective on school hours? What's their reception been to a change like this?
I'm glad you asked that question, because often teachers' needs and their personal lives and their work as educational professionals is not taken into account. I can tell you that I was involved in a major research study in Cherry Creek, Colorado, the school district there, where there were 25,000 students that were engaged in this five-year research project. We assessed the teachers' experiences before and after the time change for them. The teachers, by and large, basically said the time changes were positive for them. Elementary teachers said the kids came to school eager, ready to learn, and not having been up since 6 a.m. And at 9 a.m., they're kind of already half their learning time is gone. So the elementary teachers love the fact that the kids came ready to learn. On the other hand, the high school teachers said they had many, many fewer students falling asleep in class. So they had better luck just in terms of getting students to stay awake and when they're teaching. And the teachers' personal lives absolutely were benefited, because they weren't rushing around in the morning necessarily to get their own kids off to school or get themselves ready to school. So it's been beneficial by and large all around for the instructional staff. I can also tell you that the administrators have said without question that the mood in the hallways and in the cafeteria has been much more calm in the high schools. And there's fewer incidents out on the playground for the younger kids. It's just everybody's in a different, better space than they were when everybody seemed to be sleep deprived or cranky because they didn't get the right amount of sleep at the right time.
Does daylight saving time have an impact on kids in school? What have you seen so far?
It's interesting that the whole issue of daylight saving time has risen to the forefront of discussion among pediatricians. And I can tell you that the springtime change, when you spring forward, it's easier on young children because they tend to be early risers. So we lose that hour of sleep. And for about a week, right after the time change happens, it works really well. And then these young children adapt and adjust to the early time change. The reverse is true for teenagers, because they tend to be late risers in the morning. So for them to spring ahead in the spring, they actually, a study has shown that they lose about a half hour of sleep every night for the first week after the time change, because they it just totally messes up their brain sleep-wake cycle. So all that being said, it takes about a week for both teenagers and pre-teenagers to have their internal clock adjust to the time change during daylight saving time. But the reverse is true. Then we go to the fall and we fall back. So then we know that the fall back is easier on teenagers because we actually gain an extra hour when we fall back in the fall. So teenagers really benefit from that extra time for that week that they're still adjusting. It's just a matter of adjustment, but you know, the human body is pretty flexible when it comes to making those. I mean, we travel, people travel, and they deal with time change often enough. It just takes time. It sounds like a crazy thing to say. It takes time to adjust to the time.
Okay, well, let's now look at the opposite end of the school day. How long do kids need to be in the classroom, and how does moving the start of the school day later affect that?
Well, that's a good question, and individual school districts have to follow their state laws about the time that is called seat time for the students in classes. In general, students are in school generally 6 3/4 hours a day. Now, that is, again, state dependent, but that's ballpark, about 6 1/2 to 6 3/4 hours per day. So with the change in the starting time, say for high schools, for instance, then those that begin at 8:30 or later, they would be dismissing, say, at 3 or 3:30, accounting for lunchtime and all that, those other issues that are in the middle of the day. That still allows, and all the research we found, still allows teenagers to participate in sports without any reduction in amount of participation, or clubs, activities, even after school employment for teenagers doesn't generally begin until 4 p.m. So the dismissal time after 4 p.m. or even, 4 p.m. is pretty much the latest that is feasible for teens to be healthy, but still also participate in activities after school.
Why not have all the schools start at the same time?
That would be wonderful, but it's not financially feasible for most school districts if they have multi-tiered busing. And that means that they use the buses in several runs. So they would take a bus out and pick up the elementary age kids first, and then use the same buses to pick up middle school and then high school. Interestingly, rural school districts send out one bus to a outlying rural area, and they will pick up all students, kindergarten through 12th grade, in the same bus. And so that allows actually everybody to benefit, because the bus run picks up all the kids at one time. They bring them to their appropriate schools in a rural school district, and it works out really well for everybody. But it is not practical when you have a school district, say, of 10,000, 15,000 students to run, you'd be running buses all over the place. And it's easier for them to be busing certain ages of kids with each bus run.
What have the kids had to say about the school schedules?
The earliest studies that I did in 96, cell phones didn't exist then, okay? Which was an amazing contrast to do the studies now as compared to what I did in 1996. Because without cell phones and social media, the high school students in those years, absolutely, they changed the time change and they got an hour and a half more of sleep every night. But now with social media and phones and computer tablets and homework turn-in time being midnight, it's really negatively affected the quality and the timing of sleep, especially of students that have access to a phone. It's really changed the dynamic of getting adequate sleep, especially for teenagers, yes.
This is How Time Works, an Odyssey conversation produced by Dennis Foley.
Be sure to download the free Odyssey app to listen to your favorite radio station like this one anywhere at any time.
I'm David Rankin.
And I'm Kristen Diaz.
And that was How Time Works.
Z.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.